I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
U.S. forces are running into fierce resistance as they continue to move into the heart of Baghdad today. Iraqi snipers have been firing on U.S. troops from inside Baghdad's al-Rashid Hotel, despite earlier reports that the hotel had fallen under coalition control. Iraqi forces are also taking up positions in and around the University of Baghdad. This, as an Iraqi missile attack south of the city, claimed the lives of two U.S. soldiers and two journalists, one from Spain, the other from Germany. Also today, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan called for a greater role for the U.N. rebuilding Iraq after the war, and the worst friendly fire incident so far in the Iraq war. BBC correspondent John Simpson was part of a convoy in northern Iraq, mistakenly attacked by an Allied jet.
This is just a scene from hell here. All the vehicles on fire. There's bodies burning around me. There's bodies lying around. There's bits of bodies on the ground.
And in Baghdad, despite the battles there, the city's buses are still running. The Associated Press reports that at the capital's main bus terminal, nearly 500 people stood in line waiting for a ride.
Joining us now on the line from Baghdad is Washington Post reporter Anthony Shadid. And Anthony, what military activity are you seeing now in Baghdad?
Well, it's tapered off toward evening Baghdad time. This morning was by far the most intense fighting that we've seen in the capital since the war began about 2.5 weeks ago. It started with artillery rounds, tank rounds, rifle fire, and it continued pretty intensely throughout the morning.
How is this impacting the civilians there? We're reading lines for bread and gasoline. The Red Cross is reporting hospitals overwhelmed.
There's definitely a steady flow into hospitals. And one hospital I was at today, many of the wards were filled with civilians. It seemed to be mostly shrapnel wounds that they suffered. Others complained that bombing was hitting both civilian and military areas or that they've been caught in a crossfire. The streets of the capital were definitely deserted today. There were very few people outside. And I think a lot of people were bracing for worse to come by basically hunkering down in their homes.
Yeah, we hear a big demand for both U.S. journalists and at the Red Cross to try to make phone calls out of the country.
That's right. You've seen that more and more. In fact, yesterday there were crowds outside the ICRC office. The ICRC has opened up a phone line for people to call for 2 or 3 minutes to anywhere in the world. And there was a crowd of about 100 there in the afternoon.
Yeah. What do we make of these conflicting reports about just how much U.S. troop presence there is in Baghdad? It might be funny here in the States to see images of U.S. tanks rolling in while also watching the Iraqi press conferences and having officials say there are no U.S. tanks rolling in. But how are those contradictions being received by the people in Baghdad?
Well, it was a bizarre moment this morning when the information minister was denying any U.S. troop presence, and then across the river within sight of the hotel, it was obvious that the fighting was going on at the Republican presidential palace. I think there's a lot of confusion on the part of people in Baghdad. They do listen to Iraqi radio, and they also hear BBC, for instance, or Radio Monte Carlo, the Arabic language broadcast. And in conversations with them, in private conversations, you do have them asking, well, what's the truth about this? What's the truth about that? There seems to be just a search for trying to find out exactly what's going on in their own city.
You describe a scene in which Iraqis and journalists gathered to look at an American tank.
That's right. The Iraqi government has done as best as it can to kind of illustrate its gains in this war. And one incident was taking us to a tank yesterday that was stranded on the road to the airport. It was destroyed, and journalists, escorts that the information ministry sent, as well as soldiers carrying rocket-propelled grenades and rifles, were clambering over the tank. You know, at one point, it was a little alarming. A U.S. jet flied low over the tank, and within a minute, everybody had scurried for cover. I think all that remained was a lone journalist still sitting atop the tank itself.
Anthony, you also were taken to see a bomb crater in another neighborhood. Tell us about that.
Well, it's in some ways you can say that the journalists that are in Baghdad right now are the first to see the devastation of American firepower from the other end, in contrast to the embeds who have been working with U.S. forces. And the crater today was a clear show of that. It was 25 meters deep, perhaps 25 meters across. Four houses were destroyed. The neighborhood that was struck, Mansour, is known to have many houses for the Iraqi leadership, and that may have been the target. But the devastation was remarkable. I mean, it stretched for probably a kilometer in each direction with signs, dangling from wires, glass strewn in the streets. The destruction was quite complete.
Anthony, thank you.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid, correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke to us from Baghdad. You're hearing the sounds of British fire engines in the southern city of Basra. After 2 weeks, British forces say they finally secured this second-largest city in Iraq. Associated Press reporter Lourdes Navarro is in Basra. Lourdes, what's the situation there now?
The situation in Basra is very chaotic at the moment. Yesterday was the first time that really British troops went in full force, really trying to control the city. They left the center of the city, which is the old part, pretty much alone. So they saved that for today when they sent in the British paratroopers on foot into the city. And while this was all going on, there was just the chaos on the streets. People really were looting everything they could find. They went into the main bank. They went into one of the very expensive hotels there and took away chandeliers, took away ceiling fans, which were a particularly popular item, desks, bedding, plates, anything you could see. It was really on the streets, just swarms of people in carts taking away anything that they could get their hands on while the British troops came in and while obviously the last vestiges of Saddam Hussein's regime crumbled.
Lourdes, that might be a sticky situation between the civilians and the British troops. So how did they react to the looting and how are the Iraqis reacting to the British troops?
Well, really, it was quite something. The British paratroopers that I talked to who go in on foot patrolling the city, they were shocked at the level of welcome that they received. Really, Iraqis that I saw coming out onto the streets, surrounding the tanks, handing flowers to the soldiers, and children coming out and laughing and trying to engage with the British troops. So very welcoming scene. On the other hand, of course, you have the looting by the Iraqis while this changeover happens. And the British said it really wasn't a problem, the looting for the moment, as long as there wasn't any threat to any lives.
Lourdes, what about the reports that Ali Hassan al-Majid, known as Chemical Ali, Saddam Hussein's cousin and the man who ordered the 1988 poison gas attack against the Kurds, the reports are that his body was found and that he was killed in his home, apparently, in Basra.
That's right. There has been, of course, a lot of speculation about what had happened to Chemical Ali, and indeed we received confirmation today from a British soldier, Major Andy Drake, who said to us that indeed he had received a briefing from his superiors indicating that indeed Chemical Ali had been killed on an attack on Saturday in his house and that their body had been identified.
Mm. What about the humanitarian situation? We'd heard that there was such a lack of water in Basra.
That's really driving through the city. We're journalists in a car. We have water in our car. Everywhere we go, we were almost lynched because they saw we had water. People are incredibly thirsty. When I speak to people on the streets, they tell me that they haven't had clean water, drinking water, for 2 or 3 days, and that they are in desperate need. They're coming out with anything that they can to try and see if British forces or passing journalists or anyone in the city will provide this kind of water. So the humanitarian issue is going to be a very serious one.
Lourdes, thank you.
Thank you.
Reporter Lourdes Navarro speaking to us from Basra in southern Iraq. Well, for some analysis of the latest military movements in Iraq, we turn to retired Colonel Bob Killebrew, who's also currently a consultant with the U.S. military. And Colonel, U.S. forces can seemingly move in and out of Baghdad at will. They've secured one of Saddam Hussein's bombed-out palaces. What's your sense of what the U.S. tactic is at this moment?
Well, my sense is that we're still trying to unseat Saddam's regime, and we're trying to do it without any more bloodletting than is necessary in Baghdad. And in a kind of a curious way, it seems like we've taken a page out of the Brits' playbook down in Basra. Incursions into the city, demonstrating we can get in there, taking on the more diehard resistance, and then coming back out again and not getting trapped in bloody, destructive house-to-house fighting.
Well, do a list for us, if you will. What do you see as being positive for U.S. or British forces in the ongoing fighting, and what are some negatives you're seeing?
Well, there have been a number of really, really positive developments over the last 2 or 3 days. I think one of the leading ones is that the Brits have secured Basra in the process of doing so. The fight in Baghdad seems to be going our way. Our casualties remain low. There are several reports of chemical weapons having been unearthed by the 101st Airborne Division. That's still not confirmed, but we should follow that closely.
Well, let's stay there for a second. This is a Reuters News Service report that we've seen that U.S. biological and chemical weapons experts believe they may have found an Iraqi storage site for weapons of mass destruction. There are unconfirmed reports of sarin at a site south of the central Iraqi town of Hindiya. What does this possible discovery of, as they call them, WMDs, mean for coalition forces?
Well, there are three things that are really interesting. On the tactical level, the soldiers are glad that nobody's shooting at them, which is good. The fact that it's there indicates that the keepers of those weapons may indeed have fallen for the U.S. and British line, that if you fire these things at us, it's a war crime and we're going to eventually get you.
What do you mean by fallen for?
Well, that's been our position ever since this war began to show up on the horizon.
So you mean there's almost a little bit of psychological warfare
here,
perhaps?
Absolutely. And we've been very plain on that since the first days, and we have broadcast it to the Iraqi leadership.
How much does the Bush administration need to discover some of these weapons, because, in fact, this was their reasoning for going to war in the first place?
Well, that's the third point, isn't it, that the first two are relevant to the battle itself. The third point's a much larger picture. Hmm. One of my gentle criticisms of the way the war has gone so far is we don't yet see the emergence of a strong alternative Iraqi leadership like a Charles de Gaulle, for example, around whom the Iraqis can rally.
Mm. Let's talk about some of the other reports you've been hearing. The report that so-called Chemical Ali, this is the cousin of Saddam Hussein who ordered the gassing of the Kurds in 1988, it's been confirmed by U.S. officials that he was killed in Basra. What's the significance of that death?
I don't think it's much very significant now. The more significant thing is that the Iraqi command and control in the south, of which he was apparently the head, has been destroyed. There's one more positive thing I'd like to just point out, and that is that the Iraqi Minister of Information was really kicking Al Jazeera around the other day.
In fact, kicked them out of Baghdad at one point.
He did indeed. And if you believe that a good news service's job is to make everybody mad, Al Jazeera may be graduating to that stage.
Colonel Killebrew, look ahead for us. What do you see the U.S. forces having to think about in the days ahead?
Well, of course, we need to consolidate Baghdad. But my concern is that we not get so fixated on taking the city, and we certainly want to prevent Saddam or his lieutenants from escaping out the back door into the north part of the country where we have no forces, or into Syria possibly, and constituting a government on the run. We did not realize, I don't think, how traumatized this population is. These folks are not going to move until they're absolutely sure that they're out of reach of Saddam and the Ba'ath Party that has kept them traumatized for 20 years. There won't be any dancing in the streets in Baghdad. There will be a slow realization that they're free. And that's not going to happen until they're positive that Saddam and his cohort are not going to come back to town and deal with people who support the Americans.
Colonel Killebrew, thank you.
My pleasure.
Retired Colonel Bob Killebrew is also a consultant on defense issues. He spoke to us from Newport News, Virginia.
Just ahead, our D.C. roundtable. President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair meet in Northern Ireland, but will there be a meeting of the minds?
And later in the program, Gulf War Syndrome and efforts to make sure this mysterious illness of the last war with Iraq doesn't plague soldiers again.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush heads for Northern Ireland today, of all places, to again sit down for the third time in as many weeks with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Blair, of course, has been Bush's most unwavering supporter throughout the war with Iraq. Many observers now, though, are on the watch for wavering, predicting Blair will not see eye to eye with Bush on administering post-war Iraq and on Israel and the Palestinians. And what about Northern Ireland? Our D.C. roundtable is here to discuss it all. David Shribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Hello, David.
Hi.
And Jack Farrell, senior Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe, joins us. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
As tumultuous as the war in Iraq, of course, remains, flashpoints still in many other places. There were clashes among Israelis and Palestinians today and bomb threats in Northern Ireland today. David, after so much harmony between these two heads of state through thick and thin, what could cause dissonance between them now?
Well, there's a lot of opportunity for dissonance. And if you look at the alliance between Roosevelt and Churchill during World War II and you realize what happened to the American-Anglo relationship afterwards, there was a period where, in the famous phrase, Britain lost an empire but was searching for a role. I think Britain's worried about that in the aftermath of the Iraq War as well.
I think one thing that Blair is looking for is a sort of triumphal summit meeting with the American president. You know, the war in Iraq, despite its successes, was never as popular in Britain as it is in the United States. And he's going to want to try to show the British people that coming out of this war, there's going to be diplomatic gains that match the military gains.
Well, the United States still seems to be in a very unilateral mode, and Britain seems very much to want to build bridges to the rest of the world.
Britain lives in a much different neighborhood than the United States does, and Britain tolerated the U.S. break with the U.N., but now it can't really live in Europe, where half of its heart and one of its feet are, without better relations with the Germans, better relations with the French. Take a look the way the crime reporters do and policemen do, follow the money. Britain's trade relationships with Europe are very, very important, far more important to Britain than ours are to Europe. And besides, Britain is not a superpower, and it has to worry about how the other guys in the neighborhood regard it. The United States certainly doesn't feel it has to worry quite so much.
Well, the United States doesn't have to worry quite so much, Jack, does it, about what France and Germany and other places think? They seem to be putting that tone out still from Washington that, look, we're going to do this our way. We expended the blood and treasure. And if anybody else wants to help out down the line, well, we'll see.
Well, as far as administering a post-war Iraq, we probably could do that. As far as changing the world to the point where the threat of fundamentalist terrorism is eliminated, we can't do that by ourselves. A lot of the big gains that we're going to get in the war on terror are going to come from friendly intelligence agencies, for example. A large part of the development of the new Iraq and the new Middle East is going to have to rely on something other than just American dollars. And so realistically, as much as we say we're going to fight this war the way we want to fight it, in the back of our minds, we always will have to remember that we have allies around the world and that these allies are very important and that together the rest of the world is as tough as we are.
Now, certainly, David, the United States is more allied to what Ariel Sharon wants in Israel than Britain, right? Isn't there the potential for real tension between the U.S. and Britain over what to do about Israel and the Palestinians?
Yes, and I think that tension comes really less from Prime Minister Blair than from the other members of his Labour government. They were willing to tolerate, although uncomfortably, his dalliance with Bush on Iraq. But they will not tolerate, I'm predicting, they will not tolerate any of the Bush rhetoric on the Palestinian question and the Middle East in general. And, of course, Britain has long, long interests in the Middle East. They go back to 1882, and it's not going to be easy for Blair to turn a blind eye to them.
I mean, the fact is, Jack, isn't it, that the United States will demand, as the Israelis do, that all Palestinian terror end? Isn't Britain more likely to say, no, let's try to create some sort of a structure, and terror inevitably will continue until we start to put some sort of a process in place?
I may be proven wrong on this, but I would not be surprised if one of the adjustments that is made after the war in Iraq is quieted down is that the United States position on Israel begins to shift more towards the British. I think that one of the things that the United States is doing for Israel in this war in Iraq with this expenditure of blood and treasure is take a big weight off of Israel, and we now have some justification to go to Israel and say, we've done a lot for you now. as part of our greater plan for peace in this region, we have to resolve the Palestinian issue, and this is the way we think it should happen.
David, just to finish up now, what about Northern Ireland? Does George Bush have a sudden interest in Northern Ireland, or why are they meeting in Belfast?
Well, why did Roosevelt and Churchill meet in Quebec, and why did they meet with Stalin in Tehran? Maybe it's just a convenient place. It certainly is a symbol of a place where warring tribes have got to come to peace and have come to a little bit of a peace. So maybe there's some symbolic value there.
Jack, have you got any sense of why they're meeting and whether George W. Bush may be bringing any thoughts on Ulster? I mean, sort of course, President Clinton became so involved in the Northern Ireland situation, or is it all just a kind of a coincidence?
No. There's definitely been a modest, behind-the-scenes but steady American push from the State Department, from Richard Haass's office, to deliberately work on the problems in Northern Ireland with the British. The Catholic community feels much more secure in its negotiations, and there's actually some hints that possibly out of it this weekend you could have an announcement that could show even further progress.
Well, I want to thank you both for covering a number of topics with us today. David Shribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
And Jack Farrell, senior Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the war in Iraq is just the latest bad news for the U.S. airline industry. We'll check in to find out how air carriers are dealing with a major drop-off in business.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the State Department issues its annual report card on human rights worldwide. Some countries with bad grades are among the coalition of the willing.
Also, what's being done now to prevent a repeat of so-called Gulf War syndrome that plagued soldiers who returned from the region in 1991?
And our literary critic, Steve Almond, reviews some of the best writing to emerge from the last U.S. war with Iraq.
These stories coming up, Here and Now.
Thank you. I'm Marianne Nichols. It's dark now in Iraq after a day of fighting that saw U.S. forces barrel into the center of Baghdad while British forces were gaining control of much of the southern city of Basra. Explosions are again being reported in Baghdad tonight following the missile strikes that started today's attack just after dawn. The Army's 3rd Infantry Division then moved in and raided one of Saddam Hussein's palaces. Iraq's foreign minister is denying that any Americans are in the city. In Basra, there are reports that several Iraqi militia have been killed by citizens who turned on them. And there's been looting as British forces patrol the last major pocket of resistance in the city's old section. President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair are meeting in Belfast today to discuss post-war Iraq, the Middle East peace effort, and the dispute in Northern Ireland. The reconstruction question in Iraq has divided the U.S. and Britain. Prime Minister Blair wants a deeper United Nations involvement in post-war Iraq than the president does. Bush wants a transitional governing authority of Iraqi exiles and people living in the country now. Meantime, UN General Secretary General Kofi Annan is taking a hard line on UN involvement in post-war Iraq. Annan said today that only the UN can bring international legitimacy to the process of rebuilding Iraq.
There have been series of discussions in Europe where the European Union has come up firmly on the side of a greater UN involvement. I do expect the UN to play an important role, and the UN has had a good experience in this area.
Annan says he is asked to meet with the UN Security Council to discuss post-war Iraq. The first of dozens of Cuban dissidents accused of collaborating with American diplomats will serve up to 25 years in prison. The sentences are part of the Cuban government's recent crackdown on about 80 members of the Cuban opposition. The dissidents include journalists, leaders of labor unions, and opposition political parties. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a 50-year Virginia state law banning cross-burning. A divided court ruled that burning crosses remain a symbol of racial intimidation, and that outweighed First Amendment rights. The decision overturned a lower court ruling that said the law inhibited free speech. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 155 points at 84.32. The Nasdaq is up 32 points at 14.25. 33 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Here and Now.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The State Department has released its annual report on human rights around the world. Iraq, not surprisingly, comes in for severe criticism. But according to a State Department spokesman, rights violations are even worse in North Korea. Also, the report points the finger at torture and repression in a number of U.S. allies, members of the Coalition of the Willing who support the war in Iraq. We're joined now by Tom Malinowski, the Washington Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Tom, your organization broadly agrees with the conclusions of the State Department. Tell us what countries stand out as the worst violators of human rights in this report this year.
Well, it would probably take the entire show to discuss all of them. Certainly countries like North Korea, which you mentioned, Iraq, China, which comes in for very heavy and very appropriate criticism every year in these reports. A number of countries in the Middle East that are allies and friends of the United States, including Saudi Arabia and Egypt, are rightly criticized for suppressing political dissent, for torturing prisoners. Other countries that were somewhat obscure before the war on terrorism put them on the front pages, like Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, countries nearby to Afghanistan, are rightly cited for, again, complete suppression of democratic freedoms.
Now, you mentioned Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan is a member of the Coalition of the Willing, and a number of members of the coalition are pointed out in the study as being violators of human rights. Uzbekistan, Eritrea, Azerbaijan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. What kind of company are we keeping?
Well, I think it ought to be troubling to folks, particularly with respect to some of those countries that you mentioned that aren't really doing anything as members of the Coalition of the Willing apart from signing their names on a dotted line. A country like Uzbekistan, I think, has signed up hoping to ease U.S. criticism of its human rights record.
Now, Secretary of State Colin Powell, whose State Department produced this report, says that we do engage with these countries whose policies toward human rights we don't support. We discourage them from behaving that way. But are we doing enough?
I don't think we're doing it enough. I think, first of all, it's fair to say, as Secretary Powell said, that the United States is engaged to some extent in all of these countries behind the scenes, urging them to clean up their acts. But it tends to shy away from confronting allied countries more directly, more openly, more publicly.
Tom, the State Department report also condemns secret detentions, closed hearings, and interrogation tactics, which are called under an umbrella heading stress and duress, such as sleep deprivation and the shackling of prisoners in painful positions. The report says all that, of course, amounts to torture. These are all tactics that are now part of President Bush's war on terrorism, are they not?
Well, that's right. The State Department calls it torture, and the Defense Department and the CIA call it stress and duress. It's another, we could say, inconsistency in terms of the administration's approach to the world, one example of many, unfortunately. I certainly hope that that folks at the White House and DOD read this report very carefully and ask themselves whether the United States is really going to have the moral authority that it needs to protect and promote human rights around the world, if it is seen as engaging in some of these cruel techniques itself. The administration hasn't addressed that inconsistency yet.
Tom Malinowski, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Tom Malinowski is with the NGO Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C.
After the Gulf War of 1991, tens of thousands of U.S. veterans complained of a range of medical problems, loosely called Gulf War syndrome. But a lack of information about what soldiers were exposed to during service and what their medical conditions were before they left frustrated efforts to get diagnosis and treatment. Well, now, both the Defense Department and the Veterans Administration say they're working to prevent that from happening again. WBUR reporter Rachel Gottbaum has been covering the story. She joins us in the studio. Hello, Rachel.
Hi there.
Well, just to recap, what were some of these symptoms the first Gulf War veterans were complaining of?
Well, there's some basic symptoms that the majority had: headaches, joint pain, gastrointestinal problems. But they were also varied and all over the map. And it was hard to tell what's related, what wasn't related. The government did find that Gulf vets were twice as likely to get ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. But otherwise, it's been very difficult to document. I spoke to Shirley Jackson. She's the Persian Gulf coordinator at the Veterans Administration in New England. She's interviewed 3,000 vets.
Some people have joint pain, and that's what they have. Some people have headaches. Other people do not have headaches. There is no one set of symptoms that fits a profile. Unlike measles or mumps or some type of disease that we could have a label for, Persian Gulf vets do not have this.
Rachel, you talk about a lack of information. Tell us more about that. Why is it so hard to tell veterans what's wrong with them?
Well, a couple things. First of all, they didn't expect veterans to come back with these complaints, so they didn't really know what to do. Also, they kept minimal records of vaccines, of what they gave vets, of what they were exposed to in the Gulf. Mm-hmm. I spoke to the head of Veterans Affairs in the Bush administration, and he just says that they really didn't pay the attention that they needed to.
We did not have in place the mechanisms by which we could gauge their health before they went into the combat theater of operations, Iraq One, and when they came home.
So, Rachel, what's happening this time around? How are they going to change things?
What Principi talks about is the fact that they are going to coordinate like never before. In fact, they are coordinating like never before with the Department of Defense. Now the Department of Defense is taking on a new role. They are banking blood specimens of troops before they go out, and then they are following up when they come back. They are keeping databases of everything they give those vets. They are also tracking and monitoring when they are coming into sick call and what they're complaining about, because they may not be able to detect what they've been exposed to. And the way that they can figure it out is by tracking when vets are coming in complaining while they're in the desert and when they come back.
This would seem to the outside observer to be something that, you know, you sort of wonder, why wasn't this done before? Is this really such a cultural shift for the military?
According to the military, it is, because Rumsfeld's mission is to win the war, not to figure out who might get sick and who might not get sick. Basically, now they realize that they essentially have to make the health of the troops and monitoring it before and after a priority. And I would say that what is symbolic of the cultural shift is the following. When you talk to the vets now, they say, nobody talks about what happened to me in the Gulf as connected to my problem. Now, there is a mandate for military doctors. The first thing they ask a vet when they come back and say, I don't feel well, is, do you think this has anything to do with your time in the Gulf? And that is a complete change.
Right. The information will come from the grunt, if you will, up. Well, Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
WBUR reporter Rachel Gottbaum.
Still to come, it's a small genre, but a powerful one, literature of the first Gulf War.
You're listening to Here and Now.
How does a dancer who's had both hips replaced stage a beloved ballet, a work created for her a quarter century ago by the man she calls the most influential choreographer of the 20th century? Well, with great care and lots of hard work. Former New York City ballet great Merrill Ashley recently spent 3 weeks teaching the challenging Ballo della Regina to Boston Ballet dancers. It was choreographed by George Balanchine, the Russian whose centennial will be celebrated next year. Here and Now's Lynn Menegon spoke with Merrill Ashley about the challenge of preserving the Balanchine legacy.
Cross, cross, cross. Big step front. Big step.
Dancers love dancing Balanchine ballets. They love it. All his ballets have some inner heart that leaves a dancer feeling good.
Straight knees, girls, straight knees, tight feet.
He created American ballet. He brought American qualities of life, energy, speed, freedom, and a joyful spirit, too. It's a very happy ballet, very joyful. The music is very lighthearted. It's Verdi's ballet music from the Opera Don Carlo. And my particular skill was moving at very high speed, very clearly, cleanly. And also, my favorite thing to express on stage was the joy of dance.
What does fast mean in this ballet?
It's sort of like if you hear advertisements on the radio where they have to put in all that legalese at the end and have somebody talking like this, and they manage to enunciate every word, but you don't know really what they're going to say because how can you know? And you can't imagine talking that fast. Well, Ballo's kind of like that. I don't want people to look like a clone of me. They have to be themselves. And if they can't do the steps quite the way I did, it's my job to try and help them find a way to look good and be true to themselves and yet be true to the ballet. And it's hard. Hopefully you will see people moving very quickly with a lot of clarity and precision and with a joyful spirit.
And run, 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 run. That's better.
Mr. Balanchine died in 1983. It's a whole new generation of dancers who never knew him. Are they forgetting his style? Is it in danger of fading somehow?
It's very, very difficult to make people want to go through what you have to go through to acquire those skills. And I don't think there's anybody on earth right now that can inspire people to go to that degree anymore.
Do you have hope for preserving the Balanchine legacy?
Oh, absolutely. I think, first of all, I think Balanchine ballets are being done by more companies around the world than they ever were. And people really devote themselves to learning and acquiring as much skill and as much knowledge about the ballet as they can. So I think people will appreciate Balanchine ballets, and I think they'll stay alive. I think people recognize that they're very deep and beautiful and precious things to have in one's repertoire and to watch.
Our piece on the Balanchine legacy was produced by Lynn Menegon.
There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
War is horrifying, sometimes morally ambiguous, and the stuff of great books. Think of Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead, Catch-22 by Joseph Heller, Tim O'Brien's Vietnam-era The Things They Carried, or Rumors of War by Philip Caputo. But what stories have come out of more modern conflicts? How have the stories of war been told post-Vietnam? Here Now's literary correspondent Steve Almond is in the studio with a few books in hand to explore that. Hi, Steve.
How you doing, Robin?
Fine. Give us an overarching thought about these newer offerings.
Well, I'm going to talk today about three books that came out of the Gulf War. And I guess what's important to observe, most of the books that you mentioned are really very personal books about wars that were quite long and complicated and in which individual soldiers faced the sort of crises that make great literature. And as a result of that, there are a lot of books about World War II and about, and not just wonderful fiction books, but also nonfiction books. I cannot say the same for the body of literature that exists for the Gulf War, in part because it was such a short conflict, and the situation for soldiers overridingly was one of profound boredom and confusion and restlessness.
But we should remind ourselves that the bombing in the first Gulf War was 39 days long. We're not even approaching that here. So you have brought us, as you said, three offerings, fiction, nonfiction?
Well, a couple of fiction books and a memoir as well. And I guess I'll say of all of these that they are characteristic of Gulf War literature. Again, we're not talking about a vast oeuvre, but of the books that exist, most of them deal with the conflict in an oblique or absurdist manner. And that's not unusual in war. It is such a painful, wrenching thing, as we're all realizing now as this conflict drags on, that sometimes humor is the only way to deal with it, or a kind of absurdist approach. And that's certainly the approach that Tom Paine, the wonderful writer Tom Paine, took in his prescient and very, very silly and wonderful novel, which is called The Pearl of Kuwait. It is in the tradition of something called sea stories, which is a Marine Corps tradition, which is basically like a big, long, shaggy dog story. It is a big, confusing, sprawling, wonderful, nutty novel about basically a couple of Marines, 19-year-old Marines, who go AWOL and rescue the Princess of Kuwait, whose name is Lulu. And there was actually a Princess Lulu in Kuwait who decided to stay in her country. I'm going to read a little section that's her initial encounter with a guy named Chami Trang, who, interestingly enough, is essentially a bastard child of the Vietnam War. The narrator is Cody Carmichael, who's this 18-year-old surfer dude who's Tommy Trang's best friend. Mm-hmm. Someone was singing out there in the dark across the rippling waters of the Persian Gulf, and without another word, we both started to stroke quietly toward the beautiful voice. It was a young woman's voice singing in Arabic, and we were pulled to it like by a massive body magnet. We were barely able to see the dark outline of a funny-looking Arab rowboat of some sort, and in it a little figure dressed in black outlined against the quarter-moon night. And then, of course, they go to rescue her. Trang yanked the final strands of the rope apart, and we drove her hard to the surface. I held her head above the waters while Trang flopped in the dinghy and then dragged her aboard. There was no way I could get in the dinghy, too, so I just sort of treaded water and held the dive light so Trang could see what the hell he was doing. And he announced that the naked Arab chick had a pulse but wasn't breathing, and I said to start CPR. And with his, like, palms supporting, he gently bent her neck back. Her lips opened, and Trang lowered his head, and just as he pressed his lips to hers, her eyes snapped open and locked on Trang, and then she started gagging up seawater. Anyway, that kiss, if you can call CPR a kiss, was like the real beginning of all the adventures in Arabia for Trang and me.
As the book flap says, Romeo and Juliet meets Lawrence of Arabia.
That is just the beginning of a really strange and chaotic series of events. They essentially go into Kuwait again, and they're constantly the sort of underlying ironic twist of the book is these guys are so eager for a battle. They want to be heroes. They want to die a hero. And that really was how a lot of the soldiers felt in the Gulf War, as we know now from having heard from them in their own memoirs. They were promised that there would be some kind of ground fight. And as we know, though there were lots of bombing, there was really very little fighting to be done.
So the line between fiction and reality is definitely blurred in The Pearl of Kuwait by Tom Paine.
Okay. Yep. The same can be said in Baghdad Express. It's a nonfiction book by Joel Turnipseed, and he's written a memoir called Baghdad Express. He's an interesting character who's a philosophy student, basically, dropped out of school, got dumped by his girlfriend, and was essentially AWOL from his reserve unit in the Marines, and ended up over in Kuwait. I'm going to read a little excerpt from a section called Getting Lost. He was on a supply train. That was his job. I couldn't even find Jubal, he writes. Instead, I drove all the way to the Gulf, stopping at traffic lights in a city that looked nothing like Jubal. At best, I was cruising through the suburbs like an ammo-laden idiot. I ignored the stares of Saudis driving Toyotas, looking back and forth between me and my 155mm shells. I gave them a cursory nod, then exhaled a drag from my cigarette like I was totally cool on a secret mission or something. I also want to read a short excerpt that gives an idea. He does encounter, even though he isn't on the front lines, he does encounter some soldiers, Iraqi POWs, and he writes, "A grim procession of soot, grime, dried blood, matted and greasy hair, dead and distant stares, hollow cheeks, the meek and wretched going to the collection of their inheritance. Our eyes did not meet. I was so tired that I grew dizzy from the strain of avoiding them. Who had honor? Probably neither of us, none of us." So there is, in the midst of this kind of absurdist picture, a much more real and sobering view of war.
Joel Turnipseed, that was, and the book?
Baghdad Express, it's called.
Okay.
Well, the last thing I'll read from is a series of stories in a novella called Dear Mr. President by Gabe Hudson. Hudson was, in fact, a rifleman in the Marine Reserves, and he's a very, very funny writer. I'm going to read from the title story, which is called Dear Mr. President, and is, in fact, a letter to the first George Bush, written by a Lance Corporal James Laverne, who has gone somewhat out of his tree. If Sodom's biologically laced devil air had ever come and tried to crawl down our mouths and noses and into our lungs, the red pills would have been there to say, "Hey there, Sodom's biologically laced devil air, don't even think about it. There's no way you're getting into this American nose and mouth. Nuh-uh. Don't you know that America's the greatest country on earth? You might as well go back to where you came from and try to crawl inside the nose and mouth of the devil himself, Saddam Hussein. Now scram, devil air." And one of the curious things about all of these books is that they're really oddly prescient. They were written at a time before we knew we were going to be in another conflict. And The Pearl of Kuwait by Tom Paine in particular talks about Trang's mission ultimately is to go and get Saddam.
So the current conflict can make these books about the former Gulf War resonate.
Absolutely. And I recommend that folks in this time, if you can bear to pry yourself away from your various news outlets, it is important to recognize there's a larger human context that writers try to write about and help us cope with, not just being in, but also taking in a war.
Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
Here in House literary correspondent Steve Ahman is also the author of the book of short stories, My Life in Heavy Metal. For a list of his Gulf War recommendations or to suggest your favorite wartime literature, we've already heard from many of you, visit our website, here-now.org.
Before we go, a summary of news the war in Iraq has pushed out of the headlines.
The Supreme Court has upheld Virginia's state ban on cross-burning. In a 5-4 ruling, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote that a burning cross is an instrument of terror and that the government should have the power to stamp out and punish its use.
The Cuban government has sentenced several Cuban dissidents to up to 25 years in prison for allegedly collaborating with American diplomats. Prosecutors in Havana were asking for life sentences.
Officials in China report another death from SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome. They also revealed that Chinese fatalities in recent weeks were more widespread than previously reported. More than 2,300 people have been affected by SARS worldwide.
UN officials say that almost 1,000 people were killed in villages in the northeast Congo last week. The war-torn country is in the midst of a 4.5-year civil war.
North Korea says it will ignore any UN resolution on its suspected nuclear program. The UN Security Council will discuss this issue in private sessions this week.
And finally, this spring, winter weather in northern states has forced the cancellation of opening day baseball games. The Chicago Cubs and New York Yankees were scheduled to play their opening hometown games today, but snow in the Windy City and up to 8 inches forecast in New York caused the games to be rescheduled for tomorrow.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest war developments.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.